So we traditionally start the Dhamma talk by just doing a little chant. I'm going to start like that. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So good evening. I've been, you know, choosing to come today because tomorrow is a climate demonstration here in Sacramento again at 12 noon at the Capitol, and so I thought this is a good occasion to come to Sacramento and also, you know, speak about what's going on, you know, in our worlds. You know, we all live in different worlds, but in one sense also we live, you know, together on this planet, and we all know that there's a lot of increasing problems in regards to, you know, the climate and the environment, because the way how we have been living is just increasingly becoming unsustainable, and it looks like, you know, that if we don't change our ways, then we're gonna wipe ourselves off, you know, the planet, and it's not looking very good. And, you know, at the same time we also like at the end of an era and at the beginning of a new era, and that's, you know, a time of great uncertainty and a lot of chaos. You know, for us maybe it's more internally still, you know, but there is many people who are living in the midst of climate chaos already, you know, who are on the move and, you know, who are going through a lot of hardship. And for us maybe it's more like internally currently still, but you know, it's just a matter of time when our external lives also will be really impacted by this. And, you know, and in these times the Dhamma is in particular very precious because it gives us something to orient ourselves with in the midst of lots of things, you know, which are difficult to open to. And, you know, they have been saying that I'd like to speak about feminine perspectives in Buddhism, because there's quite a few very well-known teachers, you know, in Theravada Buddhism who are very outspoken on this, and in particular it's Bhikkhu Bodhi and also Venerable Nalayo. They are both, you know, very well-known practitioners and also prolific writers. Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated the whole Theravada canon into English. There's lots of books available from him, and also Venerable Nalayo, the last 10 years or so, is also very, you know, coming up with lots of books on what's called early Buddhism, trying, you know, to distill what is really the essence of early Buddhism. And both of those monks are also on the forefront of supporting higher ordination for women. So it looks like, you know, the monks who are very in tune with what's needed in terms of global awakening, in terms of climate change, at the same time they're also very much aware about the importance, you know, to bring feminine perspectives into the way how the Buddha's teaching is taught and kind of disseminated to people who are interested. And that's a very interesting combination, because there's also other monks, you know, who are not speaking out about climate, and they don't see that as part of practice, and they at the same time they're also not interested in supporting women for higher ordination. So there seems to be a correlation between those two things, and I thought that's very telling, really. And so I wanted to, you know, read to you a little bit from an article by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, which he, it comes from a talk he has given at the beginning of this year of 2019 at a conference in India. And he's speaking mainly, you know, to an Asian audience, mainly to Asian monks actually, but I thought it's a very interesting way how he looks at the importance, you know, of bringing feminine perspective into Buddhism. I just read a few paragraphs. And he says here, "I personally believe that for Buddhism to thrive and realize its potential, it needs to be nourished, enriched, and renewed by feminine perspectives. To give space for feminine voices, especially on such crucial matters as social justice and care for the natural environment. I would say that the full liberation of women in all spheres of life is critical to the survival of human civilization. From the dawn of history down to the present, the primary driving forces of civilization have been male attitudes, male values, male activities. I believe that the unchecked dominance of masculine values has been pushing humanity close to the edge of self-annihilation. To draw us back from the precipice, we need to listen to women. Generalizations are always dangerous, but I would posit three values deeply rooted in the masculine mind that have largely determined the course of human history. These are conquest, competition, and extraction. In contrast to these masculine attitudes, I believe the future of life on earth requires a shift toward more feminine values. I will enumerate this as threefold as well, as correctives to the extreme masculine values. In place of conquest, we need to adopt the spirit of collaboration. In promoting a culture of peace and mutual understanding between peoples of different nations, races, ethnicities, and religious beliefs. In place of competition, we need cooperation. In building a society governed by more egalitarian ideals, a society that provides everyone with their essential needs, food, healthcare, education, meaningful work, and other basic social services. And in the place of the extractive exploitation of nature's abundant resources, we need an attitude of respect for nature and a sustainable economy leading to the emergence of a culture marked by a deep appreciation for the awe-inspiring, irreplaceable wonders of the natural world. It is in promoting and actualizing these life-affirming values that I believe women can make an indispensable contribution to our shared human future. The liberation of women will not only free women from long-standing constraints, it will be indeed a double liberation, freeing men as well from their blind spots and self-destructive impulses." So I think that's a very powerful way of, you know, defining what needs to happen. And, you know, and feminine and masculine values doesn't necessarily speak about women and men, but, you know, we all have feminine and masculine energies in us. And, you know, at different times of the evolution of the human species, different energies needs to be come in the foreground because different needs are there. But in this time and age, you know, we need to become more willing, you know, to be receptive and to really listen and see, you know, the consequences of our actions. And, you know, in order to be able to really tune in and really being able to see what is going on. We need to cultivate mindfulness and clear comprehension. You know, the two most important ingredients for meditation. You have just been practicing it like a few minutes ago. And then if we could take that mindfulness and clear comprehension and turn it towards not only on our own experience, but also, you know, the consequences of our action, I think, you know, that could be really a way how we can be more connected, you know, with what we are doing, because it seems that we are not really knowing what we are doing, because otherwise we wouldn't do it. So, and you know, and with this, I'm going to come now to Viram Analio, who speaks about mindfulness. And this is his latest book, which came out last year. And he says, also mindfulness requires cultivation, being a quality that needs to be established. Such cultivation is not a forceful matter. Here it can be useful to take into consideration that the word sati in the Pali language is feminine. My suggestion would be to relate to sati, to mindfulness, as a feminine quality. In this way, sati can be understood as receptively assimilating with the potential of giving birth to new perspectives. So, you know, if we would really pay attention, it would change us. You know, and that's what the whole intention is behind meditation is, you know, to kind of step out from the thinking mind who constantly puts, you know, interpretations onto our experience, and to be in direct contact with our experience, and through that direct contact, we will be changed. Because if we would really see reality as it is, for example, you know, really deeply understanding the workings of impermanence, it would deeply change us. And in the Pali Canon, those moments of really deeply seeing which change us permanently are called the four stages of insight. First one, stream entry. Second one, once returner, non-returner, or fully enlightened arahant. So, you know, if our practice is really powerful, it indeed can change us permanently. And that would mean, you know, that we will permanently also relate in a different way. Because, you know, our conditioning gets increasingly, you know, deconstructed and let go of, you know. Because the whole journey, you know, in the Pali Canon, how it is described, it's not about gaining anything, but it's about letting go of all of those layers of assumptions and projections, you know, we have been accumulating through conditioning. And it's about, you know, letting them go through insight. And that can only happen, you know, by, as Viram Analio says so very well here, you know, receptively assimilating what's really going on, and through that then giving birth to new ways of seeing. And there's also this Pali word which is very often featured in the scriptures, called yoniso manasikara, which means wise reflection. And the word yoni in Pali means womb. And it means going back to the source, going back to what's really happening, rather than being stuck in our stories about what's happening. And, you know, currently we are at the, you know, we are still all very much stuck in consumerist stories. We are maybe at the end of, you know, of the patriarchal era, because it just really doesn't work very well. No offense, please, but when it was just an evolutionary stage, you know, which has to come to an end, because everything is impermanent. And then, you know, seeing how can we balance it out, how can we be more capable, you know, in really allowing ourselves to be taught by life itself, you know, allowing life to speak for itself rather than speaking for it. Because it isn't very successful anymore, it just doesn't work. And he speaks further on here, right away from the moment of waking up in the morning, our good friend Sati can already be there, as if waiting for us. She is ready to accompany us throughout the rest of the day, encouraging us to stay receptive and open, soft and understanding. She never gets upset when we happen to forget about her. As soon as we remember her, she is right there to be with us again. Visualizing the practice in terms of a coming back to the presence of a good friend helps to avoid mistaking sati for a forceful type of hyper-attentiveness that requires strained effort in order to be maintained. Instead, being in her presence carries the flavors of an open receptivity and a soft alertness to whatever is taking place. And this is exactly, you know, this open receptivity and soft alertness, which we need to train ourselves in. And the most important, you know, insight which can really help us to step out of this huge misunderstanding of, you know, being separate entities. The, you know, what's called in the Pali Canon not self, and what's called in other schools of Buddhism emptiness. You know, empty of a self doesn't mean, you know, that we don't exist. We do exist. I can see you and you can see me, but we exist different than from what we think we exist. We are processes in constant exchange, you know, with our environment, and also in constant exchange with each other. And, you know, whatever we put in the environment is going to come back to us. And, you know, this insight into emptiness and not self is a very important insight if we as a species do not make that step. Then probably, you know, that's probably the end of us, really. If we are not able to understand how much we are in constant exchange with everything around us, through eating, through breathing, through whatever we are doing every day, we cannot escape that truth. There's no way we can escape that. So, you know, using the practice to make ourselves receptive to the truth, that's what we really need to do. So the practice is not just about, you know, us and having like a little bit less stress in our lives, but it's really a stepping stone we as a species need to be able to make. I think it's a very powerful time to consider that. And, you know, we can't willfully get there. That's, you know, that's not how practice really works. Because practice is all about letting go, and forcefully going about practice doesn't work. Because, you know, that will just cut us really more off from what's really happening. So it's about, you know, finding ways of supporting ourselves so that we can actually stay open and not need to turn away from what is happening, and at the same time also, you know, not biting off more than we can chew. So it's like an art and a science, really, where we need to find the right balance. And, you know, one way of speaking about that balance is about, you know, having those masculine traits and the feminine traits and finding a balance by bringing them both together and within ourselves, you know. and also in our societies, in our culture, you know, making space for those voices which have been pushed into the background for a long time. And I find it very inspiring, you know, to have these two monks I have just been reading from their work, that they are so clear about that. Because Buddhism also, you know, has evolved in a time which is, you know, 2,560 years ago, where patriarchy was very much more dominant than it is now, and, you know, where women were considered, you know, to be possession of men, and women couldn't do many, many things, which, so a lot has changed since then, you know, but there are still some very basic values, how we relate to nature, which haven't changed enough. While at the same time, you know, our powers in terms of technology have increased to the extent that we can, in various ways, wipe ourselves off the planet nowadays. So to, you know, to take the practice and bring it into that arena, I think it's very important, because there is nothing else, you know, really we have got which can help us to, you know, make steps in the right direction. And it's definitely, you know, connected with a lot of uncertainty, and it's not very comfortable. It's very stressful, really, because it really takes us to the edge, you know. But in order for transformation to happen, we have to be willing, you know, to go to the edge. And we can see that, you know, in a personal transformation through the meditation, you know, if we are not able to stay with the emotional baggage which, you know, is unpacked through the practice, then transformation is not going to happen. You know, then we might just feel a little bit better, you know, when we go after the meditation session, but then if it doesn't have really a transformational effect on our emotional capacity, you know, to open to that which we don't like, then it's not going to really, you know, deliver what it actually can deliver, this practice. But only, you know, if we learn to be willing to open to unpleasant feeling. And that's what's very difficult for many, many of us, including myself, you know, that requires a lot of, you know, really dedication to the practice and really knowing why you are practicing. That's why I was also saying, you know, at the beginning of the sitting, to just remember, you know, why have you come here today? Or why do you sit? Why do you meditate? What's the reason for it? Is it just because it's a cool thing to do, or it's like a fashionable thing to do, or you don't know else what to do, or you just want to feel a little bit better, and things like that? Or do you really want to take advantage of this teaching, you know, which has survived for so many centuries because it works? So, and I hope, you know, that some of you are having time tomorrow at noon to come to the Climate March and join Diane and me there, and many other people. And some of the nuns from my monastery will also come. And just really, you know, instead of having the practice, you know, as a little thing in our lives, which we do, just put the life inside the practice. And then, you know, do the best we can and let go. And at the same time also, you know, knowing that we are all together in this, and, you know, this here is a sangha, you know, Buddhist sangha or sacramental insight, meditation sangha. And really knowing that this teaching can help us, you know, to find meaning even in very difficult situations. Because, you know, the evolutionary process isn't just about us. But we do have a certain amount of agency inside of it. And the practice can help us, you know, to understand how to act. And the easiest way is to by just investigating, you know, the repercussions of our actions and then see, do we like those repercussions or don't we? The same way, you know, how you, if you've had children, you know, you teach them in that way. And now we have to just kind of, you know, wake up to a much bigger context. And use the practice as a way to stabilize ourselves inside of that process. So I think that's, you know, what I'd like to share with you. Not in order to kind of, you know, make you feel uncomfortable or anything, but if you do feel uncomfortable, then that's just the way it is. And maybe, you know, that motivates you to show up tomorrow at noon at the Capitol. And if you can't come tomorrow, there will be many other opportunities. Maybe you can come at another time. And you know, we still have some time left, and if there's any questions or comments, or if you want to share something, then that would be a good time. Do you have a microphone to carry around? Yeah. Over there. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank you for coming tonight and making this really important connection between the Dharma and our practice and the impacts. It's basically our karma, what we're doing to the planet.
Yeah.
And I also want to just highlight how remarkable I think it is that a 16-year-old from Sweden has captured the attention of the whole world, particularly young people like herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very inspiring.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, it's great, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the young people have a more kind of impacted because they probably gonna live longer than us, you know, because most people here in this room are like, you know, not that young. Including myself, yeah. I mean, they are more scared than we are, you know. I mean, it's rarely that one has lived in a time where it's actually is a good deal if you're not that young, you know. Because in a culture where usually, you know, youth is the best thing and we should all stay forever young and look young. And nowadays it's a good thing in some ways, yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. She's an amazing person, yeah. And I think, you know, I also trust that the young people, you know, that they have different minds than we have, you know. They are not weighed down by certain layers of conditioning we all have, you know. So they also hopefully will have different way of dealing with this. And Greta Thunberg is definitely, you know, a very special person who is cutting through a lot of stuff and has a lot of courage. And, you know, capacity to really see very clearly and is very able to, in a very simple way, express what the issue is, you know. Yeah, it's great. And the whole school strikers movement, you know, is amazing. Yeah? millions of school children doing this. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And this tomorrow, you know, the whole action tomorrow will be also in support of the youth, of the school strikers, you know, we can be there, you know, to basically, you know, encourage them and maybe protect them also, you know, because when the police comes out, old women, you know, are the last ones to be beaten up, I suppose. Yes, I think, you know, there's like all of those, there's the fearless grandmothers and the 1,000 grandmothers, you know, older women, they can be very helpful, you know. I have already signed up for the 1,000 grandmothers. Yeah, they have their little website. Yeah?
I just wanted to point out that the strike tomorrow is at the California State Capitol Museum.
No, it was on the west steps.
It's on the west steps of the California State Capitol Museum. It's a strike that caused a climate change, and it's at 1315 10th Street.
Is this not the Capitol?
Yeah.
That is.
No, it's not the Capitol.
Okay.
No, it's.
I'm not from Sacramento, so I don't know.
Museum.
Okay, that's somewhere else then. Is that far away from there?
No.
No.
Just a block.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm from Austria, so sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Yes?
I'm thinking about young people.
Mm-hmm.
That I started life being very much concerned in having the values that I currently have about these issues. But somewhere along the way, I stopped living those values. Somewhere in my 20s or 30s, I started adopting cultural values of consumption or accumulation or success.
Mm-hmm.
And my generation knew better. And so as I look at the young people today that know better because they're faced with these challenges for their life, like we were faced for our challenges in the 60s. I hope for them that they do not lose their way through that challenge facing life's givens, this challenge. And perhaps I think that our role as elders might be in admitting that
mm-hmm.
loss and
yeah.
in providing for an example of return and hoping that they lose less and return more quickly than I did. And maybe that's one of our roles in with them.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I think about in terms of these issues is something that Gil Fonsdale said, that you can add balance the world by adding something that is beautiful, something that is healing, something that is contributes to well-being. The same way some people plant a tree in memory and grief of loss of a loved one, you can do something to create wellness and create beauty, just to create an ability to restore balance.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can't meet a problem head on as an individual. Sometimes you can't even meet a problem head on as a group. But you can act with intent in a more beneficial direction and just carry on.
Yeah. And I think that's also, you know, in the practice, it's like the Vipassana insight meditation and the four Brahmaviharas. You know, you need both. The four Brahmaviharas, do you know those? You know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. They're both sides are needed, you know, because sometimes you can't just go in and cut something up or penetrate or, you know, really take something apart. You can only, you know, embrace it and make space for it as it is, and then see, you know, what is the next step which becomes possible. So both of those practices are needed, and yeah, the warmth of the healing of those four Brahmaviharas is very important, you know, to build relationships and to be able to make space for what is, you know, we have set that in motion. We can't really necessarily stop it, you know. But we can, we do have an impact how we are meeting it, and you know, we can ease the hardship in through building relationships, you know, and not turning against each other because of the stressfulness of what's happening. Yeah, I think that's very important. And beauty is also a way, you know, which uplifts the heart and uplifts the mind. All of those things are important. They all contribute. Yeah.
This is just going back to what you said, Jerry, about the where it is, because the one that I signed up for, I think there are several, is on the west steps of the Capitol.
Oh.
So it may be that there's...
I think there were originally two, and they have combined themselves into one. That's what I know. Yes.
The one that I got through Susie Harrington's website, actually.
Okay.
I followed it, so mm-hmm. We'll see.
I have two.
Thank you for your talk tonight, because I think other thing is that we start telling ourselves. And yes, anyway,
I think it's, you know, that to find the middle way between overestimating and underestimating what we can do or what we have to do, you know, overestimating and then thinking we're not doing enough and, you know, running yourself in the ground that way, or underestimating what actually our right action, you know, can actually do, because it's not about, you know, one person alone having to do all of this. If everybody does their part, and then, you know, people encouraging each other by seeing what everybody is doing, that's all we can do. And we are not, you know, we are not like gods in, you know, running evolution or something like that. We don't know, you know, what this will become. We don't have control of it, and this is not our job, you know. But the only thing is that we have to do what we can do, you know, within our lives. And I think the practice is just extremely helpful for that, you know, because then we can see, you know, why do we hold back? Is it because of fear? Is it because of, you know, apathy? Is it because of anger? You know, to really see what do we bring to the situation, and then, you know, recognize, you know, how we are, you know, maybe bringing more confusion, you know, rather than less confusion. And it all starts, you know, by really seeing, you know, what we are, what's, you know, how our mind is colored as we are going about our lives, you know. Is it just like, is there a sense of complete helplessness and hopelessness, and that's why we are not really wanting to look, you know, and then investigate into that, you know, and being aware of that? Or is there a sense of, you know, I need to be the, you know, white knight in the shining armor and have to rescue everybody, you know? Or where do we come from, you know? And I think that's very important. And doing the best we can, you know, in the sense of, you know, if I would die tomorrow or if I would die tonight, you know, would I be able to die with the thought that I did what I could, you know, within my own capacity? I think that's, you know, reflecting on that, reflecting on death is actually considered a very good medicine, you know, in Buddhism, to give us a sense, more clarity about what really matters for us, you know. I think that's a very good thought to have, you know, once a day, like, if I would die today, you know, would I be okay with that? Yeah.
I recognize the importance of intention in right action. And certainly the circumstances in our environment are crying out for immediate action. For myself, I find that it's important that I have a clear intention while not being attached to the results.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that in the act of my doing what is right, is sufficient enough. And that in itself is the practice.
Yeah. There is so, yeah. And then, you know, sometimes it's also, you know, we can also look at the repercussions of our actions, because, you know, sometimes, for example, in relationship, you know, we might say something to somebody with a very good intention, but because of the cultural conditioning, for example, it lands very differently than what we intended. So it's also important, you know, to see intention and impact, and then, you know, adjust accordingly. But, it is the intention which makes the karmic imprint, but then we also need to consider the impact and maybe learn from that too, you know. Because to just only, you know, say, you know, my intention was good and I'm done, you know, that's not enough. Yeah. But it's where we start, because this is the only way we can start. Yeah?
I happened to be at the dentist today, which is a good excuse to read garbage paper, you know, magazines.
Yes.
People you don't know anything about, you still call celebrities and stuff.
Yeah.
And today what I picked up instead was Time Magazine has a special edition that's all about climate change. I haven't had time to read much, but I did read about the green fence that's on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert that was extremely uplifting. Millions of trees being planted, and they have been for a few years.
Okay.
And it's almost all women who are doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. It's a nice counter to all of the negatives that we're reading.
Mm-hmm.
I know the magazine has a lot of negatives. I haven't read them yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, yeah, with us. It's all done by women, so that's lovely. Yeah.
So, yeah, planting trees, I'm very interested in reforestation.
Mm-hmm.
And India, in one day, they planted 220 million trees.
I read that.
Right, and Ethiopia said it topped them 350 million in 12 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, so if they can do that, why not?
Thank you. Okay, so maybe I'm going to end on these very positive notes from the both of you. Yeah. Being from the forest tradition, I think that's a very good ending. So I'm just going to do a little blessing chant, you know, and that all of our good intention will bear some kind of good fruit, you know, in the midst of these times of great uncertainty and great changes. May you have every good blessing, may all the devas protect you, by the power of all the Buddhas, may you ever be well. May you have every good blessing, may all the devas protect you, by the power of all the Dhamma, may you ever be well. May you have every good blessing, may all the devas protect you, by the power of all the Sangha, may you ever be well.